So I was thinking, today we're about two-thirds of the way through the retreat. So after hearing me say that, you can examine your own mind. So, oh no, that means a third is left. Or my goodness, two-thirds has gone by. Or don't remind me of that. So we all have different relationships to these external signs, and time can be one of them, and something we're often very attached to. So it's nice on a retreat that we have an opportunity to a certain degree, drop that notion of time. I mean, you have to keep a certain connection, otherwise you wouldn't know when to show up for your interviews, or for that being said, as well as breakfast, lunch, whatever. There's some sense of time we have. So we're keeping a sense of this going in our mind, the sort of external conditions. But at the same time, what we're noticing most is our internal time clock, our internal way of examining experience. And all of you have done lots of these retreats. In order to be here, you need to have really spent some time examining the mind. So none of you are beginners. And yet, it can seem sometimes like this is like the first retreat. Sometimes you think, oh my gosh, how can this still be happening? How can these same patterns just keep coming up? Sometimes years of meditation, years of retreats, and same story about my sister. Or, my husband did that, or my daughter or son, whatever it might be. And so we have the opportunity to keep examining, to keep looking at this, but our main sense of examining the mind is really trying to look at this from an impersonal point of view, rather than taking this as me and mine and all of my horrible, no good, terrible, very bad things that I think about, do, say. We're trying to remember that this is, these are just the circumstances we've been given with our own minds, and we don't need to take it so personally. And yet, such a simple statement and such a simple thing to do, it seems like it's, although simple, the most difficult thing that can be done. So we can be quite humbled by that in all these experiences. And sometimes we do have very peaceful, calm, quiet states, or we'll have many experiences like that, and then we think, that's it, that's what I'm trying to get to. I have to have that, that's what I want to have all the time. Unfortunately, that's also not a very helpful attitude. Because, and we see that we're setting up, one situation or another where we're okay with one way that the mind is behaving, and that's our ideal, and then we're not okay with the other, and so then we set everything up in opposition. And for many, many practitioners, this can be something very easy to get caught up in. Years and years of chasing after that one peaceful moment or peaceful hour, whatever it was, that time I experienced the jhana, or that time that I had this truly pervasive sense of metta, and then decades later I still can't get back there. So as Ajahn Suchito has been teaching for the past 2-3 weeks around Satipatthana, really encouraging us to get into our bodies, to really try to have a sense that we have a body. It's so easy to forget as we get lost in our stories and thoughts. And so this has been a predominant part of our practice during this retreat, being aware of our breath, being aware of our experience, the palpable physical aspects of having a body, and the feelings associated with that. So we've also touched on vedana, and I remember for a long time when I was practicing, the first retreat I took was with a Goenka retreat, and so this was all about sensations. And so my experience of vedana was just always about sensation and tracking sensations in the body. These points of just something being pleasant or unpleasant, or noting those points. But eventually I settled more into vedana being just a response of just the sense, the general sense of how the body feels. Is there an unpleasant sense? So rather than having a very narrow point of view, it became a much broader, what's the feeling? What's the felt sense, the felt state of the mind, the felt state of the body? And that was, that was a lot easier to recognize and to understand, and it also gave more of a holistic feel. So as we're continuing to work with our practice in this way, then we're leading to the third section that the Buddha taught on the Satipatthana, which is that of mind. And it's interesting that as he teaches, essentially the part on vedana, it's just a few short sentences. It's just saying, knowing the experience of pleasant, neutral, unpleasant, and then internally and externally. Just reading that one sentence, I could do that in an afternoon, pretty easy. But it takes a lot to even, I find for myself, just to even get a little bit of access into understanding what the Buddha's teaching. And this is one of his foundational teachings, this is Satipatthana. It's something we can come back to again and again, that he suggested that if one did that, then that could be almost all of the practice, just to try to penetrate this one thing. He says just even in, if one gets it for 7 days, 7 months, 7 years. But when he actually reverses that process. So even if you're able to have this for 7 days, I think it's even, can't remember if it even goes down to, if it's down to 1 day. But it's a sense of really trying to penetrate the Dhamma in this way, and so we have a lot to examine, a lot to explore, and with examining the mind, again, it seems like such a simple teaching as he's teaching us what to kind of recognize in our own minds. But we see in our own practice, or what I would assume if you're dealing with some of the same things I are, is that this can take a lot of effort and a lot of time, a lot of patience to recognize these states. As he's just saying, simply knowing the mind with the different attitudes that we carry around, and knowing the absence of those attitudes. We think, that should be pretty easy. But then the mind moves on into, some kind of distraction, some kind of thing, and off we go into our stories. So the Buddha's teaching with this third section, he says, when one knows a mind with desire as being a mind with desire, and one knows a mind without desire as being a mind without desire. It's interesting, he doesn't say one knows a mind with desire and a mind without desire. So it's saying, like, you know that it's that there is desire, and so the mind has desire, so it's a recognition, and you're recognizing it's there, or one is recognizing the absence. So it's having that sense of absence, and that the interesting aspect of that is it might be common to have thought as he's going through these different scenarios that, well, you just notice that a mind, when you have desire, you know that you have desire. And so the question says, well, why does he instruct us to know that when there isn't desire, that we should also notice that too? Because that's not the tendency of our minds, is it? We notice sort of the negative. We notice the thing that is sort of hitting us the hardest or punching us, and rather than that very subtle sense when there is an absence of something. We don't attend to that as easily, that sort of absence of desire, absence of an attitude. And so it's no wonder that we often beat ourselves up quite a bit. I'm such a desirable person, or I am so averse to all these things. I hate this or I hate that. And we don't often think about, like, well, I actually feel kind of neutral about this other stuff, or I don't mind this, or I have no desire for that. And that's too bad, because a lot of these sort of negative states, they're good to remind ourselves, good to for us to bring up when we have an absence of something. So, for example, I'll go through some of these others. He said, knowing a mind with aversion as being a mind with aversion, and knowing a mind without aversion as being without aversion. Knowing a mind with delusion as being a mind with delusion, and knowing a mind without delusion as being without delusion. And so he says also, knowing a mind as contracted as being contracted, and a mind as distracted as being distracted. And he talks about a mind that is great as being great, or narrow as being narrow, or surpassable as surpassable, and unsurpassable as unsurpassable. Knowing the mind that is concentrated as concentrated, and unconcentrated as unconcentrated. And then there's knowing a mind that is liberated as liberated, and unliberated as unliberated. So again, that's it. That's all there is to do. Not too much. And so the Buddha is really pointing at, all of this is really pointing to right effort, how we can recognize skillful mental states, wholesome mental states, how we can bring them into our own minds, and how we can sustain them in our own minds, and how we also recognize unwholesome mental states, and we can try to decrease them, but we also try to prevent them. We prevent them from entering the mind. And the only way we can do this is through recognition. So that's through a sense of recognizing what's actually present for us. So after hearing some of those, if I just ask you, what is present for you? what's in your own mind now. What do you know? If you can't figure it out, that might be one of delusion. But if you do have something that you've gone to, some state of mind that you've been able to identify, then I'd also ask, well, did you see there that you didn't notice the absence of something? Because this, for example, in just the list I gave you, is the absence of nine qualities, or there would be eight others if you noticed that there was a presence of one. So again, this just goes to the tendency of our mind. If there's any of you that went to the eight absences, then that's quite amazing. Good for you. But we tend to move towards that which we notice very quickly, and then there might also be something else you notice, which is disappointment. Oh, I'm feeling averse again, or sort of contracted or tired. And so we have a possibility of trying to use this third tetra, this way of a certain section of the Satipatthana to kind of really keep an eye on our attitudes, our emotions, what it is that we're able to identify within the mind. And so most of us have worked with desire, aversion, delusion. These have all come up. And for me, just to say, the way I work with delusion a lot is that sense of that feeling of, I don't really know, I don't know what to do, I'm not sure, maybe it's this, maybe it's that. Or that sense that if I keep asking questions, I'll get an answer. If I just keep trying to figure it out and believing that there's going to be some answer to how I'm supposed to do something or what I'm supposed to do, then I'll get there. I'll figure it out. And that's a tough one, because if you believe that, then you keep running on that program over and over again. And so it's helpful just to know it, to say, oh, I don't know if this is actually going to go anywhere. It doesn't seem like this is going to end. And that's the belief structure, is that with delusion is it's going to end. If you're stuck in doubt, for example, you're trying to figure something out, and by continuing to doubt it, you're going to come to an end. But then if you just know it is doubt, so then you know it, just like the Buddha is saying in this teaching. Knowing delusion as a mind of delusion. And that's quite difficult, because if you're deluded, how do you know it? You know, it's a bit of a conundrum there. But that's when you catch yourself. You're saying, oh, I don't know what to do. Maybe I should do this, and maybe I don't know if sati isn't right, and I'm not sure which teacher I should have, or on and on it goes. I say, oh, wait a minute. This is just a never-ending slew of questions and doubts and misunderstandings and trying to figure it out. And you stop yourself, you have a moment of saying, oh right, this is what doubt is. And the insight can arise, oh, it's not really going to end. There's never going to be an answer to all these questions. Because the answer to one question brings another question. So that's one of the ways we try to recognize delusion, is not by answering the questions, but just knowing that it is there, that it's present. And there's other times when you do feel quite confident in what you're doing, and then there's a sense that, oh, right, I don't need to have any questions. And so right there is this absence of doubt, absence of delusion, absence of confusion. You actually do feel sure of something. And then that can also move the other way, where we have to be careful of that when we feel too assured. I know this to be true. This has to be it. I know I'm right, and everybody else is wrong. So we're still trying to really have a sense of the meaning of what these mind states are, these attitudes that we carry around. But we keep coming back to the simplicitude of the Buddha isn't saying to figure everything out. You know, he's not just get it together, figure it out. You need to be a genius level of really understanding all the intricacies of mind. He says this one simple thing is a knowing. I mean, it's incredible what that really is. It's just knowing something. So for the past almost 3 weeks now, has knowing been fairly difficult? And perhaps either you have a lot of experience or you got lucky and you say, oh yeah, it's easy. But from my own experience, just having a sense of knowing is a continuous sense of knowing is very difficult. And there can be a lot of dukkha there because we put a lot of pressure on ourselves to be the perfect meditators and to have this sense of knowing all the time. Ajahn Chah would talk about it more as like you're pouring out a vessel of water, like a pitcher of water, and as it's flowing into a cup or a jar, you know, it's just dripping when you're first learning. And then it stops. And so that mindfulness there's very little mindfulness that's gathered. And but then you start again, and eventually that drip it starts to flow a little bit more. So then eventually the drip, it loses its sense of being a drip, and it's sort of a continuous flow of water. But it might be just a little, and then you might stop again. So you might find this on retreat very common where your mindfulness increases for a week, a few weeks, a month, a couple of months, and then you go back to life without retreat, and then all of a sudden it's so easy to get distracted, so then the drips stop, or they just start a little bit here and there. So what we're trying to do is increase that momentum and that continuity of knowing. So it's more continuous. And a retreat like this, I mean, that would probably be that there's a little bit, at least a little bit of that going on. And it's not good to measure like, oh, I'm sure, you know, she looks like she's really mindful. I'm just a mess. I haven't gotten anything out of the last 3 weeks. Dripping all over the place. Even if I get any drips. And so we try, you know, we kind of think about ourselves often as less than or not having these qualities that imbibe a sense of being able to do this one basic thing that the Buddha said. It's just, how can I not get this? So it's such an easy thing just to know it. And so we just keep going. We don't have to. That's the thing that he says. He doesn't say, you know a mind with desire or absent of desire or delusion or aversion and then stop for a while and then reflect on how bad you are and how terrible you are and how everybody else is a lot better than you. That's not his instructions, thankfully. I don't know if his dispensation would have lasted that long had they been. But, you know, he just keeps saying, look at the, you know, just keep with this knowing quality. And the sense can be like, well, why would that really get me anywhere? Just knowing it. I mean, all it is knowing it. What's the magical effect here? What's that going to really do? And knowing it makes us present with what's actually going on. And if we're present with our own experience, if we're truly seeing that we're feeling desirous in a moment, then knowing it becomes a sense of attending to it. So we're attending to this experience we're having, and then we start to gain insight around that, just because we have that knowing. So, oh, I see, okay, so then if this is what desire is, this is how I'm inclining towards it. And we have a sense, is there dukkha present? You know, do we have a sense that there's something kind of maybe not feeling so good? Or if we notice the absence, we say, oh yeah, that's really nice when I don't have aversion. So you might notice that there's a particular person who you've picked up on the retreat, and you might know this person, you might not, and oh, he's doing it again. God, just walk a little faster. Please. And then what's funny is in a situation like that, you know, you pass the person, come into the hall, and then completely forget about it. It means nothing. But what might have been missed is just that mind of knowing aversion. And then knowing it, one has a sense, oh, this is not pleasant. This is not pleasant. Feeling this way about somebody else, feeling this way about myself, I'm not walking fast enough, I should be more mindful, whatever it is. We start to notice this and we see like these desires, aversions, delusion we have, or when we're in a contracted state, it's not pleasant. And so then we kind of, oh, maybe I can do something about that. Maybe there's something to be done here. And it's just that basic. That's what knowing allows us. It allows us to see clearly, like we've opened our eyes for the first time, and we have a sense, oh, right, this is actually happening. This is what's going on. I'm not in this moment lost in my stories of who I am and what I should be, thinking that this is just a something that's going to go on forever, always going to be a problem. It's just, no, this is it right now. And it's uncomfortable. What can I do about that? And so that's when, with right effort, we see there are things that we can do about that. If we notice someone, you know, we've been chanting these metta chants, the Brahmavihara chants. And so we have these four ways that we can kind of undermine difficult emotions, difficult attitudes of the mind. So some people might think that the Buddhist teachings, well, they are just that basic. You just know it and that's it. But actually, it does go a bit beyond that. So you might introduce metta in a situation where you're feeling averse towards someone. So that's something to do. So you're letting go of something. You're trying to actually say, okay, this is a mind of desire, or this is a mind, in this case, of aversion. And so this isn't something that's helping me. It's hindering my potential for experiencing peace. And so rather than holding on to it, this knowing of it says, okay, this is something to be let go of. And so then we have some motivation to let go of this state that's quite unpleasant. Again, very basic, very kind of normal for us to see. But then we want to pick something else up. So it's not like it's just all letting go, letting go, letting go. We also pick up a skillful state. So that would be something like wishing ourselves well, wishing that other person well, who we might not have the kindliest of thoughts towards. And we just keep trying to stay on that sense of knowing and then letting go and then picking up what is wholesome for us. And again, in that short example I gave you, what picking up might be is just to notice again the absence of unwholesome mind states. Because once you start noticing the absence, then you there's a sense of like, oh, that's, I actually don't have aversion here. I'm feeling pretty good. And we can have a feeling of confidence sometimes when we believe that we're just not worthy of actually thinking that we have anything that's sort of pleasant or good about us. I mean, there's a lot of absences of unwholesome states if we lend our minds there. So it's a very good exercise again to come back to, you know, when you're really stuck in something that's unpleasant and a lot of dukkha in the mind, some state you can't let go of, then you can really bring up that sense, well, at least I don't want to kill anybody. At least that's present for me right now. I might be really distracted, I might be kind of really deluded now, get caught in these things, but or just even to bring up sila, your own sila. Living in a place like this, you know, we take the precepts, take these eight precepts, and those are incredible precepts. They seem so small and insignificant, especially in a retreat center where there's not as much temptation to break them. But if you just think, if all the people in the world followed just one precept, what would that world look like? If everyone just agreed, okay, we're not going to kill anybody, you know, what would a world look like where that one precept was followed? It'd be amazing. Or I'm not going to lie to anybody. Or steal anything. Just one of those. I'm going to drink or use intoxicants. And so we also have the opportunity to recognize the goodness that we've generated in just following these precepts. And that's a knowing. That's a knowing of what we're doing and the absence of all of the unskillful acts that we're avoiding by following those precepts. And so this knowing, it really can give us a lot of confidence in our practice. Just this simplicity of knowing and allowing our minds to move from not just, as I've been saying, knowing that negativity, but that, you know, all of the good things that we aren't noticing. So when, for example, you notice desire, and it might be very overwhelming, there might be a lot, wow, there's a lot of greed right now, a lot of lust, a lot of desire, and it might be difficult to let go of in that moment. But when you see it through, you just say, okay, I'm just going to stick with the knowing of it. You know, I don't have to judge myself around it. I don't have to wish it away. I think when I get rid of this, then I'll be happy. It's just a sense of continuing to know it. Its presence is there. And then there is a purification of mind. There is a dissolution of that because it's impermanent. It might become an increased state of desire, an increased sense of the mind being on fire or lustful, whatever it might be. But then, you know, that changes too. And so then we get to have a very palpable sense of the impermanence of it. And we keep working with that mind in that way. And once we get to know that, then we're just gaining this insight. And so what that does over a long period of time, as most of you know this, having been on lots of retreats and having your own practice off of retreat, that we don't have to trust our mind so much in terms of believing in these states as being permanent. You know, I'm such an angry person. I don't know what to do with my anger. That just starts to dissolve more and more as we continue with the practice. And we can forget it. There can be times when we forget it. We call ourselves that angry person again. But then we keep gaining this insight based on our own knowledge, our own knowing of these qualities. And then that insight can arise. I'm not sure I believe in that story so much anymore. I used to think I'm an angry person, but now I just think there's anger. We can even have sometimes a very impersonal sense of that, of feeling like, oh, there Chinda goes again. No problem. Or there he goes again. And it's just, you know, it's just one of those programs or habits that we have. And it's not personal. You know, it's just something like, oh yeah, no big deal. Some anger aversion. And so the more intimately we have with these experiences, the more intimate moments we have with ourselves around just knowing these mind states, paying attention to them, and then seeing their changing nature, then we can't really take it seriously. I mean, we can, but it starts to take a lot more effort to do that. Now you think back to the first time you started meditating. What was that like? Sometimes when people begin meditating or they go on a meditation retreat for the first time, oh, I've been totally brainwashed. I mean, I started meditating, I got in this retreat, and it was like the teacher was just brainwashing me. I had all this anger and this aversion, and then I had all this greed, and like, I never felt these things before. I don't know what was going on. It's Buddhism. Terrible thing. And for those who, you know, have that experience, it's quite an amazing experience, but it's like, there's just been so much distraction in one's life that one didn't know this was the natural quality of the mind because it had been so habituated towards those unskillful states. There wasn't any knowing of it. So the first time that it was known, labeled, you know, okay, this is what desire is, then, oh, there's like it's like a completely new person because it's, that's not me, I'm not a desirous person, or I don't get angry. So over time, we go from something like that to recognizing, right, okay, this has been going on for a long time, perhaps many lifetimes, and these habits take quite a lot of effort to get to know and to allow them to dissolve and change into more wholesome, skillful states of mind. And so this requires a lot of patience, you know, a lot of, in fact, the patience is one of the things that the Buddha pointed out, Ajahn Chah has pointed out, many of my teachers have pointed out the same way, that we just need to continue to have a lot of endurance with our patience. It's like one of the main qualities one needs along the path. Because if you think the opposite, what is the opposite? Is just getting impatient, fed up. I'm out of here. I'm not going to do this anymore. Then we just give up because we think, oh, it's not working. But it's not working because we're not being patient. We're not having a sense like, oh, this takes time. And it can be really frustrating. So we're sort of like more opening. We're having a more open quality to what we're allowing for our own experience, allowing ourselves to continue to make mistakes, to continue to think we're failures, to continue to think I haven't learned anything in the past 10, 20, 30 years of meditation. I thought, oh, is that really true? I mean, there's a lot of ups and downs, but just thinking about that first time you meditated. So as we get to know these states, a couple of them I didn't talk about as much, with like being contracted or distracted. The contracted state can be one of laziness or just like the mind withdrawing, wanting to get away from experience. Sometimes just like being tired, withdrawn. Or distracted can be kind of, you know, just bubbling along, kind of like fingers on a piano, just kind of moving back and forth. So we get to know those states, and again, continue with the absence of them, or knowing the different levels that we have of them. How distracted am I? And so sometimes there can be a sense of like, I'm too distracted to meditate. And well, the attitude might more be helpful to change to, well, this is a very difficult knowing, a difficult way for me to know the mind right now, as it's so distracted that I can almost not find any present moment experience, because it just leaps off. It just keeps jumping. And so in that situation, then we just come back to that, well, can you know that? You don't have to necessarily do anything about it, but if you're knowing that you're distracted, then that's all you have to do. Even if the mind keeps jumping, you just keep saying, okay, I can see it. Just keep coming back to that awareness. So, you know, oftentimes when sitting in meditation and the mind can be drowsy, you know, we had a bit of breakfast an hour and a half ago, and this can be the time when the mind is drowsy. And so for how many of you, when this comes up, it's like, oh, I hate this feeling. Or maybe some people think the opposite. Oh, such a nice feeling. Just fall asleep. Either way, you know, there's the, if one is moving towards aversion towards it or desire towards that state, then without knowing that, then there's an absence of that attention. And so we often are caught, though, in a, oh, I hate this feeling. You keep, you nod a little bit. Oh, I gotta stop this. Try to wake yourself up. That's what the Buddha suggested you do. But also just knowing that kind of hatred against it, or that anger. You know, I shouldn't be falling asleep, or this is not the mind of an attentive meditator. And so we start blaming ourselves again. But it's possible to be aware of the experience when one is having a contracted mind state like that. And you kind of, the interesting thing to be aware of is just when you nod, or when you have a tiring experience like that, just actually switching your focus to the aversion you might feel there. This shouldn't be happening. I don't wake myself up. I really hate this. It's so painful. Actually, it's all these thoughts that are painful. It's not that the falling asleep is just falling asleep. I mean, it's just a kind of a natural thing, albeit a habit we want to try to break. But in the moment, we still have the possibility of just coming back to that simplicity of knowing. And sometimes, what can occur when that happens, when you're feeling you have this kind of torpor going on, it's actually kind of the aversion that's keeping it going. This like, oh, I hate this. Oh, I just want to stop. Oh. And just by coming back to a sense of knowing that, that sometimes takes the edge off of it, because there's something that's occurring there. It's called interest. So you have that interest in it, then all of a sudden it starts to dissipate the contracted energy, and the mind starts to move out of that, it's like, if you imagine like a tunnel or something that's getting darker and darker, but the interest then sees the speck of light, and it can begin to open that. So instead of getting lost in the feeling, you know, as we're talking about with these states of mind, we're more getting interested in the actual process of the mind, in the actual experience of a mind that, you know, that is feeling averse. And so as we're, you know, as we're going along on this retreat, and again, since many of you have a lot of experience doing this, you're very used to your habits, the way that your mind works and what it's getting into. And it's like, you know, a lot of times it just, you can recognize, oh, it's the same story, different situation. And it doesn't need to be a problem. in fact, it's just normal, isn't it? Like, well, how could it be a different story? You know, it's not like, you know, that you're going to start coming up with necessarily a story about your brother, then you recognize, oh, actually, I don't have a brother. So it's going to be, it's always going to be the same kind of things, you know? It's like, right, my sister. Because that's, I have a sister. And so it's like, these are the kind of worries that we have, the things that we're like, this is a content. And we're often just very distracted by this content. It's very typical for us. We can be worried about our health, losing something, sometimes losing somebody. You know, these things sometimes magnify in the retreat, especially around other retreatants. Oh, I can't believe I did that to him. His shoe fell off the rack. I think he saw that. Goodness. You know, or what did she mean when she passed the sponge to me like that? And so there, wait a minute. Okay. I don't know, you know. I don't know what she meant. Maybe she did mean something, but I have no idea. You know, so we have these attitudes, and then we see, that's what I'm carrying around the rest of the time when I'm not on retreat, these kind of mind states. And we just have this retreat time as an opportunity to then gain insight. A lot of the times the questions come up are like, what do I do about X? You know, I have this problem, I have to fix it, what am I going to do about it? And so over and over again, it's like, well, you don't really have to do anything. You need to start noticing what's going on. Because it's not like, well, if I do X, Y, Z behavior, then it'll stop. You know, this is sort of what we're taught a lot. It's just like, and to a certain degree, some of it's correct. You know, if it's especially around morality, if we don't want to harm somebody, you know, if we have a tendency of stabbing people, don't pick up a knife. You know, so it's like there are some physical things you can do to restrain yourself, but without the knowing of the mind, then you're missing a huge piece of this. It's a big part of what we're doing. We're not just figuring out some program to run. You know, like how do I stop putting my foot in my mouth program? Well, it might seem like, well, by stopping putting your foot in your mouth, that would be it. But if you don't know why you're doing that, you don't know your motivation, you're not aware of the attitude of your mind, then no matter how many times you stop something, it's still going to be coming out in some way or another. This habit is coming from some sort of internal motivation that we carry. And so the restraint we have, that sense of when we're actually restraining our behavior, we have to know what we're doing. We have to know what we're actually restraining. It's interesting, like, for example, the Buddha talks about sense restraint. When we hear the word sense restraint, we think, okay, right, so I just close my eyes, and I'll just put, like, some, like, earplugs in, and then I've restrained the sentences. And that's actually, it's not what he meant at all. He said, as you're engaging with your sense faculties, what is it that you're noticing? What are the signs that you're picking up? You know, what are the features that you're picking up? So if you're given to lust, you notice a beautiful person. So sense restraint isn't closing your eyes. It's like, well, what do you notice that's beautiful about them? Is it their nose hairs? You know? Is it the fact that they don't smell too good? No, you're ignoring a lot of those things. You're ignoring the things that are unbeautiful and you're paying attention to the things that are beautiful. Again, that's what, again, the Buddha keeps talking about. He says, notice the absence. We go to what are the habits of our mind that are present. So restraint is actually using our opening to our experience, but then having a sense of restraint around it. Like, well, what am I actually putting my attention to? What am I knowing in this moment? How am I attending to it? And so naturally, when we notice our own desire, and we say, I'm going to, you know, get that last bit of oatmeal that's left, or that last whatever, whatever it is that's desirable to you. You get to have a pause in that moment. Oh, I don't need to have that thing that I want. And then we say, oh, maybe somebody else might want that. And in a retreat center like this, it's sort of like, you know, the big decision of the day is like which salad dressing you're going to have. Oh, geez, what am I going to do here? Maybe I'll have all three. But then there's another process. It's like when, you know, the monks are walking through the line. And it wasn't until like the, I don't know, a week into it, then I thought, oh. Okay, which one do I want? I want to know which one. Oh, well, you decide. You know, I don't need to decide this. And it was all this pressure. Oh, great. Wow, I don't have to decide which salad dressing. Oh, and then this person gets to hopefully not feel too anxious about making that decision, but they then get to enjoy, like, oh, okay, I'm being offered the opportunity to offer this thing. I hope he likes it. But that's not what matters then, you know, because that wasn't what was, you know, what was there. It was kind of like, oh, well, actually, I'll let go of my desire to have a particular thing. I don't let go of all the desires to have particular things, but in this point, it's just like, oh, right, there's a noticing of that, and that wouldn't have become known to me unless I had seen that there was some kind of like, oh, which one do I want? And if I was acting out of desire, then it was like, yeah, I want that one. But sometimes it could have been aversion. Oh, I don't really know. I don't really want any of these or whatever it might be. If I just keep going with that program over and over again, then there's no end to it. It's just like that meditator or that person who starts meditating for the first time and then they blame it on the meditation retreat center or the teacher or whatever. And think about that in your life as to that question that Ajahn Suchito read out. That really, it was a good question, because there can be sometimes a sense of people thinking that is going on retreat like a privileged thing. And, well, yeah, it is, but it's a good privilege. You know, it's, as Ajahn was talking about, it's like, yeah, would you rather have them being a gang member and killing people, or going on a meditation retreat? But in the end, it's a really good privilege. It's a really good thing that we're doing. And we need, you know, it's helpful to remind ourselves of that, about how much goodness we're actually generating doing something like this. Even though sometimes it can be very painful and difficult, hard to notice that there's any change sometimes, or hard to notice that we're even noticing things. There's still the goodness that arises out of that, just that wholesome intention to decrease greed, hatred, and delusion in our minds. And this can be done through just, even just on a retreat like this, just the littlest things, you know. You're walking behind somebody, you get frustrated again, you know, I wish they'd walk slower, or I wish they'd walk faster. You know, maybe just space is all that's needed right now. Doesn't matter how they walk, but maybe I can just give some space. Space to my mind, space to theirs. I don't have to have them get out of the way, or be the perfect walker and walk slower, or whatever it might be. I remember when I was doing retreats, I just spontaneously started turning around in line. We would be taking our dishes up to wash them or to at least rinse them off and get them ready for the dishwashers. And then I don't know why that happened. I just kind of, a line of people, I just turned around and grabbed a couple of people's dishes who were standing in line. And then I think the first thing they were like, what's going on here? What are you doing? No, I'll take this dish. Don't take my dish from me. But it's like, no, this is a good thing here. It's okay. It's okay. It's going to be okay. And then, and that just really brightened the mind. And I wanted to do it more. So that comes out of that sense of knowing that can arise, a sense of like, what's the spontaneous, wholesome state? And how do I respond to that? And how do I act upon that? And I wouldn't have known that if I was just focusing on the negative, like, oh God, I gotta be in line again, and cleaning these dishes, and oh geez. But if there's more of the sense of even noticing that, oh, do I really want to be in a mind state, have a mind state like that? Then just that noticing then says, oh, maybe there's something positive that can be introduced here. And so, again, just coming back to that question of privilege, yeah, this is a good privilege to have. It's a good thing to engage in. And sure, there are some people who can't afford it or aren't able to do it. But there's a lot of people who come to these places and are supported by others, who are on scholarships or on work retreats or all kinds of ways that people are able to do this. And we can feel guilty about, the fact that we're able to do this and others aren't, but I don't really think that's helpful. So it's more to, I think, notice the goodness. The virtues, the wholesome states of mind that are coming about. All of the good qualities that are generated, and then each time that people come on a retreat like this, they gain insight into their own minds, their own understanding, and then they bring that out into the world. So yeah, it is a privilege to have actually encountered the Buddha's teachings, and to be able to do something with them. And even if it's just this knowing, that's what the Buddha is talking about is so paramount for us. Because it's the first step, it's the first thing we can do is to know. And without that, then we're going through our lives just reacting to our habits and programs and rituals. And then, as we read this or as we recited this morning, we're the nature to age and sicken and die and be separated from those that we love. And that's just what happens in life. That's everybody goes through those things. But we're also the owner of our actions. So by participating in what the Buddha's teachings are, we can change the results of being the home of our own karma. And so we just continue on with this knowing, and then through our own insight, we increase all of the wholesome and skillful states until we eventually know that a liberated mind is liberated.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.